Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, delivering clarity in a world of constant noise. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insights and expert analysis from the leaders and decision makers who are shaping our future. Whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay ahead with the stories that matter. And coming up on the program, the Democratic Alliance's Helen Ziller on the controversial Land Expropriation Act. Why some sector professionals say the National Health Insurance Scheme is dead in the water, the Economic Transactions Index and what it spells for the economy going forward, and is South Africa ready to produce green hydrogen energy? The costs are astronomical. It's Wednesday, the 12th of February. The Democratic Alliance has filed papers in the High Court challenging the recently signed Expropriation Act because it says the act is both unconstitutional, substantively and procedurally. Well, let's explore this now in a little more detail. It really has become a contentious issue. DA Federal Council Chair Helen Ziller is with me and leads our program today. Helen, a very warm welcome. Do you believe you have a winnable case?
Thank you very much, Jeremy. Yes, I do believe we have a winnable case. I'm always very careful before a case goes to court because you can never say that you're certain, but I think we have a very strong case.
Why have you likened this legislation to, and I quote you, the dark days of apartheid?
Well, I don't think I used those exact words, but I definitely used the word apartheid. And I'll tell you why. Because there are so many people in and around Cape Town that I know and that I've spoken to who had the state expropriate their property to make it a white group area and then move them away with minimal compensation. And it's taken them years and years and years to get title deeds again for their houses. So that should be a grave warning to all that you don't give the state that kind of power. You don't give the state a kind of open-ended power to start expropriating property with less than market value or no value at all on a kind of open-ended process. That is fatal. Our restitution acts, which are very important and which the DA supports, the Restitution of Land Rights Act and the Land Reform Act, envisage restitution for past dispossession, which we completely support, but they also envisage a cut-off deadline for that, because the drafters of those laws understood that you need property security to have investment and to have growth. And so that is why they had those cut-off dates. This new 12.4 in the Expropriation Act just opens a door on the never-never and creates massive insecurity of property. And we don't believe that a government should have that power again.
How do you respond to critics who say your opposition simply is about protecting white-owned property rather than ensuring equitable land distribution?
Well, we absolutely support the three acts that are driving equitable land distribution. We are very frustrated with the government's inefficiency in getting it going and their complete incapacity to manage the process. That is the Restitution of Land Rights Act. We're perfectly behind that. And the two Land Reform Acts. And we're very frustrated at the government's just incapacity to get that moving. And it's not going to help to have another provision that extends the government's powers into an act where it shouldn't be in the first place. So the Expropriation Act is meant for infrastructure. It's meant for when the government wants to build roads and bridges and railway lines and dams, and they need to cut across your property to do so, and then they should be negotiating fair market value with you. But there are times at which it could be feasible and adjudicable in a court of law where it might be less than market value. But that's for very specific purposes. The Expropriation Act has never been meant for restitution. There are three other acts that deal with that. But now, because the ANC passed a resolution in 2017 at their Congress, which said there has to be an instrument, a legal instrument, for expropriation of land without compensation. They're sneaking it into the Expropriation Act. And we can't accept that. And that does not mean to say that we're protecting white property owners. We're protecting every property owner. We want more and more people to own property. That's why we're giving out so many title deeds where the DA governs. We want more and more people to be property owners. We want them to have title deeds, and we want their property security to be defended.
There's no doubt this is a political hot potato. And let me ask you if this court challenge is an admission that you've run out of political runway, that you are lacking the political power to oppose land expropriation head on, and therefore you've turned to the courts.
Well, we certainly have the political power to do that. We could bring the government down. But you can bring the government down once, only once, and then you lose all your influence. If you've got a solid case that you can take to court, you take it to court. That's what you use. And we have a solid case, we believe, to get this act declared null and void. And we would then start from the beginning and fight it all the way. We're taking this case to extend our political runway, not to close it.
Helen, within the corridors of power, so to speak, is there still discussion or negotiation happening, even though you've gone to court? Is there still room for any kind of compromise? Is there willingness among your partners within the GNU to discuss this further?
Well, we always hope there is, but they are bound by the ANC's conference's resolution. They tried to change the Constitution. If you remember, Clause 25 of the Constitution, we put up a massive fight against that. When they couldn't change the Constitution, they went for the Expropriation Act, which is, as I've just explained, the wrong place to have this. So we are obviously talking. We never stop talking. We would like to talk much more, frankly. We would like to have one-on-ones with the ANC on a regular basis. But we've looked at what it would take to amend that act to really get to the substance of the problem, and it would really take an almost entire redraft, frankly.
You talk about collapsing a government once. I'm interested to know how much stress this really is putting on the GNU right now.
Yes, it's obviously putting on stress. I mean, you know, we're not there to make up the numbers for the ANC to implement the National Democratic Revolution. We are not here to do that. The ANC needs to get that message loud and clear. And they may think the DA's got no alternatives because we don't want the EFF and MK to come into power. But I can tell you, even less does Cyril Ramaphosa and his colleagues want the EFF and MK coming into power, because the price of that would be Cyril Ramaphosa's political life. They will insist on getting rid of him. So, you know, we've got, I think, more leverage, actually, than we are using. And I think we will use more and more and more of it. We obviously don't want to be in a fight with our coalition partners all the time. But then we've got to have some victories. And we've got to make it very clear to them that we need real, tangible victories.
I'm interested to know how you reconcile the legal opposition that you are applying right now to this act with John Steenhuisen's willingness to support Cyril Ramaphosa's diplomatic efforts to reassure the United States. It does seem contradictory.
Well, we have said to the ANC that if you're going to pass laws like this, you must expect the West to reject us. On the other hand, we also understand what it'll mean if America and Western countries cut off aid and trade. And we obviously do not want that. We want South Africa to continue being an ally of the West, actually. That's what we would ideally like, because we support the values of constitutionalism, the rule of law, a market-based economy, non-racialism, all of those things which are a product of Western thinking. And so we are absolutely committed to driving those closer links. But we're saying to the ANC, if you're going to be a center of geopolitical forces that are increasingly being seen to be just an anti-Western conglomerate that acts, for example, as a proxy for Iran to go to the International Criminal Court and other things like that, then the West is going to clap us hard. We would also very much like to say to President Trump, do not punish ordinary South Africans for the failure of the ANC. Do not cut off the AIDS relief money that you have given for so many years, the $8 billion in PEPFAR. do not cut off our preferential statement under the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act. Do not impose sanctions on South Africa. Please expand trade, don't diminish trade. And we know President Trump, we know he's going to say, well, you know, what does America get out of this deal? And at least we've got to be non-aligned. At least. We like to say that our foreign policy is non-aligned, but it isn't non-aligned. I mean, what are we doing with so many rogue states and aligning with anti-democratic forces around the world and then claim to be non-aligned? Suddenly in Russia, we're non-aligned, but in the Middle East, we're not non-aligned. You know, it's very, very, very strange to me.
So I think I'm hearing you say that you're not giving much chance of success to this diplomatic delegation to the United States.
No, we are. You know, I mean, we've also got our own channels that we're using all the time. And the channels that we're using all the time is to say, please don't punish South Africa. We've got the highest unemployment rate of any country that records unemployment in the world. And the most critical thing for the future stability, which is in the interest of the United States and in the interest of the West, is to grow the economy and to create more jobs. You don't grow an economy without investment. You curtail investment if you don't have property security. So on the one hand, we're arguing with the ANC about what is needed if we want to rescue South Africa. On the other hand, we're saying to President Trump, don't cut South Africa's throat. We're dealing with the problems, but please do not cut South Africa's throat. Please continue with your support and help us fight these crazy policies.
Thank you very much indeed. That's DA Federal Council Chair Helen Ziller. Appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
All right, from the land expropriation debate to the medical sector, and fair to say that the country's healthcare system is at something of a crossroads, the government remains committed to the National Health Insurance Act, but many experts are arguing that it's unworkable in its current form. We've heard that before. Now, the Universal Healthcare Access Coalition has now put forward an alternative, a pragmatic, it says, evidence-based reform plan that aims to improve both public and private healthcare without overburdening taxpayers. Joining us now is Professor Alex van den Heffer, a key member of the steering committee of the coalition. Professor, welcome. You've called the NHI unworkable and unfixable. Just remind us what your key concerns are. What are the key flaws in the plan?
So there are sort of two key aspects. The one is that it proposes it is essentially only feasible if there's a massive tax increase that's introduced. And that is in order to be able to substitute the contributions made to medical schemes and draw them into the public health system. In other words, draw them in as public revenue. That is not feasible. We're at tax capacity. That can't be done. The second aspect is it proposes to basically unravel two major parts of the health system in order to create a third version we've never had. So this centralized purchasing structure that they propose. That both of those aspects make this proposal largely unworkable, and it involves a massive deviation from the current health system and is very unlikely to ever be implemented. So those are the reasons why the NHI process actually is just going to hold us back on actual reforms, because it'll never be implemented, but they will implement nothing while they wait to implement NHI.
So your argument then is the single tax funded model for NHI is financially unsustainable. So how does the coalition's mixed funding model work and improve on this?
So all countries basically have to have, certainly if you're not in the top sort of five or six industrialized countries, you have to have a mixed model. You have to combine tax financing with some kind of contributory system. But in order to make people contribute to the sort of contributory system where you pay for access to insurance, for instance, is that you have to, it can't be a tax. It has to be that you're paying for your own coverage. But you have to make that a workable and accessible system. The tax finance system needs to be governed properly. So our proposals basically say there are enormous flaws in both our systems. To mix them, you have to make sure that we have a well-governed free public service and we have a well-governed contributory system through medical schemes. We can't actually cover medical scheme members in the state. It's not going to happen. We have to have a contributory regime. The two together provide universal coverage in that people face either no or very limited point of service costs in accessing healthcare. So you're removing the access barriers at the point of service through being either covered through insurance or covered through the state. So that's the model. The overall framework focuses on correcting what's flawed in both of the existing systems and focusing on those issues, which government is basically just not bothering about.
You talk about improving governance in public healthcare, all well and good, but what specific changes would you recommend to depoliticize management and improve efficiency, given over so many decades there is a lot of entrenchment now?
Yeah, so there's a lot of vested interests who don't want any governance reform in the public health system because too many people have their fingers in the pie. And that's why nobody basically focuses on it and there's no political will. In essence, what you require is sort of two broad features that we discuss. One is that you decentralize the system, that is, you create more autonomy in the delivery side of services, coupled with supervisory structures that involve no political appointment. So you create a method by which you sever you create a distribution of functions between what the executive of government is responsible for and the administrations and the services are responsible for. So it proposes independent boards in which people are not, there are no political appointments, and they oversee hospitals with a lot of decision space and district authorities with a lot of decision space. By that I mean they've got autonomy, total control over their organization, as opposed to the fragmented structure we have at the moment, where a person in charge of these facilities has to defer up a hierarchy or has to defer to other organizations in the state to get anything done in a public facility. They have limited control, but they're also the wrong people in charge. So essentially, you need to change the governance model in the public system so that people who are capable of running hospitals are appointed and they are removable, replaceable by independent boards that supervise most of the major parts of the public health system. And we make suggestions on an appointments authority that would actually be independent of politicians, that would appoint the people into the supervisory boards. And this has nothing to do with the advisory boards that currently exist that are largely completely useless. They involve political appointments and they also have absolutely no power to do anything. They're largely just useless.
Staffing is the one issue. You also reference institutional corruption, which is a major issue in the public healthcare system. How would you address this problem?
So the institutional corruption arises, as you would see from the Zondo Commission and every assessment, is that the moment you have political appointments into a system, you can capture key parts of the system. You can capture the procurement processes. Appointments themselves are an enormous part of corruption. You appoint people, friends, cronies into the system. The appointment process also impacts on the quality of people who end up in leadership positions. So if you have a political network that's basically focusing on capturing a state organization, they basically appoint a network in. And they're on all sides of the decision-making process. So the way in which you eliminate that is basically creating these independent structures that are responsible for appointments and removal of people and are responsible for overseeing the chief executive. That's absolutely critical. There's no way to stop corruption in our public system or any part of the state at the moment unless you create these fire breaks in the public system.
Thank you very much indeed, Professor Alex van den Heerfer, key member of the Universal Healthcare Access Coalition. I appreciate your time today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's economy showing signs of recovery in 2024, but as we step into this year, the latest data from Bankserv Africa's Economic Transactions Index is suggesting perhaps a more subdued start. So what does this mean for businesses, consumers, and I guess broader growth prospects as far as South Africa is concerned? Independent economist Elise Kruger, who works on that project, is with me now. Elise, so data shows a subdued start in spite of the nice rebound that we saw last year. What does this tell us about the underlying momentum of the country's recovery?
Yes, Jeremy. Actually, as you mentioned, a small drop in the Betty in January really signaling to me that there's a, I would almost want to say, conflicting, offsetting factors at play in the economy at the moment. So we've seen some sectors doing quite well in January, to which this data refers. For instance, on the vehicle side, you know, we've seen passenger car sales up by like 18% year on year, whereas we've seen on the manufacturing side and the broader private sector, actually those indices coming down. So it seems like there are some sectors doing well, some sectors are struggling as we start this year, and you know, manufacturing definitely one of those. And on top of that, we've got sort of an overlay of uncertainty given the global tensions playing out, and that has resulted in this sort of fairly sideways movement in the economy in January.
The big problem here, of course, is manufacturing, particularly in the steel sector, as you rightly point out, with the bottom really falling out of that market.
Yes, indeed, it's on a couple of fronts, but I think the steel side, base metal side, has been the main focus of the latest, you know, sort of weakness in the sector. But there are a lot of, you know, factors still at play that are negative for the manufacturing sector overall. And we're going to need to see changes in those, you know, to really take that sector forward. And actually, if you look at it post-COVID, you know, the manufacturing sector has been, you know, just muddling along, not really recovering, you know, to the same extent than other sectors. So there are some structural issues in the manufacturing sector.
So if the index has been treading water since the middle of last year, are there fresh drivers that are needed to move our economy into a higher gear?
Yes, indeed. You know, I've seen the Betty sort of being stuck and just moving sideways. And we really need to see a couple of factors, you know, moving sort of this year to get us to get more economic impetus and sustainable, you know, fresher momentum. I'm thinking on the one side, we've got cyclical factors, which will hopefully help the economy. We've got a second year where inflation is well under control, expecting an average of about 4% in 2025. You know, that will mean we're in right bang in the middle of our target band. It could hopefully mean even a further cut in interest rates. So we've seen interest rates coming down. You know, this year, if you compare January to last year, this time we are down by 75 basis points. That should help the consumer. Also, a second year of real wage increases, and that is really an important factor because that drives purchasing power. And there we can see some more growth coming through on the retail side. But on top of that, we urgently need more structural reforms. So it's happening, but it needs to be accelerated so that we can push the economy forward.
And if that doesn't happen, Elise, are you concerned that South Africa is now at the risk of deindustrialization?
Indeed, there are definite signs that we are moving backwards in terms of especially our manufacturing sector, with like ArcelorMittal wanting to close the doors. We've seen other noises made in some of the other sectors as well. So we need a firm, I would say, plan of action from government to look at our sectors and how we can help them, you know, to reinvent, almost to move forward in this sort of fairly uncertain global economy.
And none of this, of course, is helped by the new geopolitical tensions that we're starting to witness, such as the new US trade tariffs and our response to international trade pressures.
Indeed, Jeremy, I think, you know, the uncertain overlay coming from the global side and also the reaction out of South Africa, I mean, this past week or two has been volatile in terms of, you know, potential new wild cards for our economy as we move forward into this year. So, you know, as much as it's not certain at this point in time what the full impact will be, both on economic growth, I think one thing is certain, it's not going to be positive on a net basis. And also the negative confidence impact that we are seeing playing out is a definite negative for the economy in this year.
Let's come back to the core purpose of this index, and it's to look at economic transaction. And I'm wondering if financial innovation like real-time digital payments are having a positive impact on our economic activity and therefore transaction volumes in South Africa, and whether that might lead to an improvement in some of those indices.
Jeremy, I think so. When we have seen that especially online transactions and online transaction methods have gained a lot of prominence in the last while, and also the fact that we are seeing those transactions being offered at cheaper transaction costs have enabled a bigger portion of our population to become part of that. So especially if you think of something like PayShop, one of our new real-time payment methods that has rocketed in terms of volumes. It's quite cheap to use that as a payment method. If you've got your phone, if you've got an online and need a bank account, you can register, and it's very cheap for money to move around. So that will definitely be an enabler of economic activity, and it can also be used, for instance, at even a spaza shop. So that just enables, economic transactions to be cheaper and easier, which should help the economy.
And all of this, of course, is contingent on interest rates, because if the downward trajectory continues, there is a little bit more liquidity.
Indeed, interest rates will help if we can see further cuts. Although I think, I would say the whole scenario is not necessarily based on interest rate cuts further, but that's an enabling factor, that's a push in the right direction. If we can see cost of capital coming down more, that will help the households, that will help businesses. So I hope that we can get that window of opportunity for, say, one further cut of 25 basis points as soon as possible.
Elise Kruger, thank you very much for talking to me today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, green hydrogen is hailed as a clean fuel of the future. It offers a pathway to decarbonize industries like transport and manufacturing. However, recent analysis suggests that we may not as a country be just ready to produce it at scale. I think the challenges are high production costs, infrastructure deficits, and also the need for substantial investment. And all of this poses significant hurdles. I want to dig into this a little bit more. I'm in conversation now with Professor Craig McGregor, Director of the Solar Thermal Energy Research Group at Stellenbosch University. Craig, a very warm welcome, and thank you very much for talking to me today. The challenges that I've just mentioned in preventing large-scale green hydrogen production in the country, is that how we stand at the moment, and is there a way around this, do you think?
Jeremy, thank you. So it's a very complicated thing. The problem is green hydrogen is just so expensive. It's equivalent to paying $400 a barrel for oil or 10 rand a kilowatt hour for your electricity. So that's not something that people really want to do.
But it's being touted as a savior to the energy problem in South Africa. Are you suggesting that it's still a long way off?
I think we're talking a long way off. We have a lot of progress we can make in other opportunities, Jeremy, such as solar and wind power that are competitive with alternatives, whereas green hydrogen isn't. So we should be going to those options first.
Have you crunched numbers, Craig, in terms of the level of investment then that is required to establish a viable green hydrogen industry in South Africa?
It's horrendous amounts of money, Jeremy. I haven't actually looked at the full investment for South Africa. At the moment, we can't see a viable pathway to get there without substantial subsidies from into green hydrogen. And, those subsidies would either need to come from the South African government, which we know, is very, very constrained, or come internationally.
So I'm also hearing you say then that we need to start ramping up our efforts as far as solar energy is concerned. Are we doing that apace?
No, there's a need to accelerate that for sure, Jeremy.
And how do you go about doing that?
I think we're getting to the position where the country is opening up its energy infrastructure. The IRP by the government has provided opportunities. It's there's a market that's starting to develop. So we need to promote all of those things.
Do you think there is sufficient government policy or regulation in play, either facilitating the rapid acceleration of solar power or, for that matter, green hydrogen as well? Is there a sense that there is a plan on the table here?
So I think the government is very well positioned in terms of aspirations. They want to expand in these areas. I think it's a bit more where the tire hits the road that the problem is, that the policy framework might be there, the implementation is lacking.
Is there a link between renewable energy capacity, Craig, and its ability to influence the potential to produce green hydrogen down the line? In other words, is there a symbiotic relationship between the different platforms of renewable energy?
So for sure, Jeremy, green hydrogen depends on renewable electricity, so solar and wind to be produced. I mean, the definition of green hydrogen is it's produced from green electricity. So you need to start with that. And as we've discussed, we're very far behind with the deployment of wind and solar. So until we've got a good portion of our grid on green electricity, we need to focus there rather than trying to make very expensive green hydrogen.
Are you suggesting, Craig, that we need to shelve our aspirations as far as green hydrogen is concerned, or just slow things down?
I think it's more about being realistic with our intentions, Jeremy. We need to, green hydrogen, as you started in your introduction, has a very important role to play, and we mustn't lose track of that importance. But we must realize also that it's not something that's going to happen in the next 2 or 3 years. So we must be planning our investments and our strategies, but focusing on the important things like wind and solar that we can implement now.
I'm interested in the investment side, though. We've seen a recent 32 million euro grant, I think it's 32 million euro, from the European Union in advancing South Africa's green hydrogen initiatives. Given the high costs of implementation and production, as you've suggested to me, is this useful or just a drop in the ocean?
I don't think to call it a drop is even maybe too a bit big. One of these, you know, if we're talking about what the European Union is trying to do with green hydrogen, one of these facilities would cost roughly 1 billion euros. So that's both the renewable, and that's just the hydrogen component, not talking about all the renewables, the wind and solar you need. So 1 billion euros is a lot of money, and we need 20 or so of those, 20 to 40 to get to the European targets for 2030. So it's massive quantities of money. The subsidy or seed funding is really around just doing some initial paper studies. It's not going to get very far.
The sense I'm getting is it's a long timeline for South Africa to become a competitive player in the global green hydrogen market. I've been in conversation with Professor Craig McGregor, Director of the Solar Thermal Energy Research Group at Stellenbosch University. Craig, thank you very much indeed. And that's our program for today. We're back tomorrow with another 30 minutes looking at issues driving South Africa's business, political and social environment. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.